भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय भगवते वासुदेवाय नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवी सरस्वती व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरये। थैंक यू वेरी मच। वी रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भगवद गीता एज इट इज चैप्टर 2 टेक्स्ट नंबर 26 ऑनवर्ड्स। व्हाट आई फॉरगॉट टू मेंशन लास्ट टाइम वाज फ्रॉम टेक्स्ट 25 टू टेक्स्ट 28 इंक्लूसिव कृष्णा stresses one main point and one secondary point. The main point is do not lament. So today's verse carries on that theme of do not lament from text 25. And this theme will go on to text 28 at least. And then the other point associated with it is, but do your duty. Don't lament and do your duty. So in the verse last week, it was a summation, a conclusion to all the points Krishna has been making since Natvaivaham Jatus Nasam. That because the soul is never to be destroyed, never to be changed, never to be become unmanifest. Therefore, tasmat, therefore, na anu sochitam arhasi, you do not deserve, you should not lament. So this theme today carries on with a slightly different context. Krishna says basically, you should not lament even if you don't believe in the soul to be eternal. Atha chainam nitya jatam, nityam va manyase mritam, tathapitam mahabaho nainam sochitam arhasi. So note those words, na enam, for the soul, sochitam, you should not lament, sochitam. So Krishna has concluded tasmad in the previous verse. Now he's saying atha cha, even if some or other you are not convinced about the eternality of the soul, you think that the soul enam, this thing I'm talking about, nitya jatam, is always born, nityam va mritam, and also it must therefore necessarily die every time, the soul, not just the body. And even then, you should not lament. Now, before we go into the translation, there's a point to note here that Prabhupada made this point in the previous purport that there is only one source of having knowledge about the soul. And that is because the soul is really beyond our own sense perception or our ability to discover. We pride ourselves in the modern world on discovery, but if something is beyond your discovery, what then? You see, there's two things. Either anything beyond your discovery doesn't exist, or exists, but then how would you ever find out? You'll never find out. By definition, it's beyond the scope of your discovery. Adha okshaja, beyond akshaja, the reach of your aksha, not just eyes, but any of your senses. So this phrase attacha, Krishna is saying, well, Manyase, you may think, even though it's beyond your own ability to understand, I've told you about the soul, but even so, if you don't have belief in me, in what I told you as the truth, even then you should not repent. So Prabhupada made the point in the previous purport that beyond Vedic revelation, there is no way to have access to this knowledge of the truth beyond the reach of our senses. In other words, whatever we can understand by the reach of our senses is actually very limited in its sphere. It doesn't have great scope. So you see, it's a very faulty process altogether. Not very reliable. And unfortunately, of course, we're conditioned to think, placing a lot of emphasis. I'll believe when I see it. In other words, subject to my own senses being able to perceive. Anyway, so the other point is that because Krishna says tatha api, atha cha and tatha api means it's not correct, this idea of believing other things or what's within the scope of your senses. Even then, not only should you not lament, but the point is not lament in the context of doing your duty. You see. It's not lamenting per se Krishna is objecting to. It is this hesitation, this lamentation, when we don't want to do our duty. That's what. So this duty, in other words, Krishna is putting so much importance to doing one's duty, and what belief you may have is not so important. Isn't that interesting? Sometimes we think we should impress upon somebody the right belief. But they may or may not, but the action should be correct. At least this is what is being emphasized by Krishna himself. We haven't even mentioned Srila Prabhupada, what he's going to say, but just the words, atacha, even if you don't accept. Now the translation, if however you think that, manyase, the soul, all the symptoms of life, enam, is always born, nitya jatam, and dies forever, you still, tatha api, even then, you still have no reason to lament, O mighty Abd. Meaning, you have no reason to lament enam, about this soul, or about the symptoms of life, because they're inevitable. Because you think they are nitya jatam, and vāmṛtam, nityam vāmṛtam, they also must die. But if they are inevitable, then why lament? Do you see the point? How does lamenting about the inevitable do anything? So this is Krishna's point. Srila Prabhupada writes, there is always a class of philosophers almost akin to the Buddhists. This manyase, who believe nitya jatam, nitya vāmṛtam, who do not believe in the separate existence of the soul beyond the body. They have this conception that the soul is really a product of the body. It's an interesting idea of reincarnation, the Buddhists have, that unless he's free, he will reincarnate, even though he is not separate, the soul is not separate from the body. And Prabhupada is saying that there's always such a class. It's not since the Buddhists. It was there in the time of Lord Krishna. When Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, it appears that such philosophies existed. And they were known as the Lokayatikas and Vaipashikas. Such philosophers maintain that life symptoms take place at a certain mature condition of material combination. The modern material scientists and material philosophers also think similarly. So this is the appeal of the atheist. This is the appeal and the understanding, and it's a mistaken, because they don't accept this idea of Vedic knowledge. They put a lot of reliance on empirical knowledge that can be tested in the laboratory. So Prabhupada then says, the science of anthropology is based on this philosophy, on this idea that life symptoms develop by interaction by the physical and chemical elements. And it's funny, you see, because anthropologists, atheists in general, they accuse, let's just say they accuse the theistic philosophers, the theistic people, the people who accept Vedic knowledge, as being anthropomorphic. They think we superimpose human qualities to God. We attribute human personality to an unknown deity. Whereas really, it's the reverse. The anthropologists think that they're imposing this idea on elements, on matter, that it has the qualities that it can that it has the potential to be a human. So that's actually anthropology. But see, Kali Yuga is where it's topsy-turvy and it's hypocritical. The person who is guilty of something, he will accuse the other person of that same fault that he's guilty of. So the scientists, they're guilty of this idea of superimposing human qualities to dead matter. They insist this is dead matter, but it has gained human qualities. So actually that is anthropomorphism. They have just imposed on something that doesn't have these things, but they have, it's a belief system. But they accuse the persons who accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the people who are imposing human nature on God. It's actually the so the question is, what do the, in this context, in this play of words, what do the Vaishnava believe? The Vaishnava believes we are part and parcel of the Supreme Deity. We have human qualities because He has them. So we're not imposing our nature on Him. But He has other more amazing qualities which may not be found in the human. So actually it's beyond this idea. But this is how Kali Yuga is played out. It's always based on hypocrisy. So in a very nice saintly assembly like here, you will all listen, but if there was an atheist amongst you, by now I would have had a lot of things thrown at me, because they become violent, they don't accept it, they reject it violently, you know, against this idea, and will not let you make an argument. Currently, many pseudo-religions, now becoming fashionable in America, also adhere to this philosophy. They are nihilistic, non-devotional Buddhist sects. Just like, in other words, they share the same idea of the Buddhist philosophy, that some or other, they don't have an idea of the soul being separate from the body. So they don't speak of the soul per se, but they speak of the life symptoms that come into being and that die. So Krishna says, well, even if you think that, that's what happens, you should not lament. Krishna is not wasting his time with the atheists. So, Prabhupada goes on to that point. Even if Arjuna did not believe in the existence of the soul, like these atheists, there would still have been no cause for lamentation. No one laments the loss of certain bulk of chemicals and stops discharging his duty. So now the question starts to come up, why this emphasis on duty? Now, of course, without Krishna's argument, the effect this atheistic philosophy has on people is they become whimsical, would be an understatement. For them, there is no right or wrong, because there is no meaning, there is no sense, there is no higher purpose. But Krishna is kind of co-opting that idea for his point, which is that since it does not matter, why should you stop doing your duty? Now, what is not explained so far will be the subject of the Bhagavad Gita as we go on, is why duty is so important. Now, I know I'm sitting in the midst of people who understand not only duty but service to Krishna. But actually there's a lot of significance even to a devotee about why duty is very important. And actually, it is in that context Krishna is speaking of duty. Krishna, after all, you have to remind yourself, is speaking to a devotee. He's not speaking to a non-devotee. Arjuna is a devotee. And he is telling him about duty. But of course, right now Krishna has raised a very, extreme case of, well, Arjuna, just in case you don't believe all this, well, why should you stop doing your duty? So in any case, whether Arjuna accepted the Vedic conclusion that there is an atomic soul, or he did not believe in existing soul, he had no reason to lament. So Prabhupada elaborates on that, how so many living entities are generated and they die at every moment. But nobody has a parade for grief and awake, all these chemicals have died. There's no need. I'm trying not to necessarily delve into each and every part of the purport, but I want to get to the main flow. So, in other words, just one point before we proceed. Even though there are people who accept reincarnation, they're not accepting the soul. They have this sense, this is a Buddhist idea, that somehow or other, even though you're not a separate soul from the body, this, whatever name they give it, this soul, it disappears when you become liberated from repeated birth and death. So now they use the word reincarnation, and this is a caution for devotees to not use the word reincarnation. Reincarnation actually means that you die and you're born again. We don't actually die and you don't born again. You travel. You transmigrate. You are there in this term of your body. You are there when the body dies, and you're there in the next body. You're there in between each body. But according to the reincarnationists, really you are born, you die, born again, you die, born again, die, until you can get free. That's the Buddhistic idea, meaning you become nothing. So, and here's how Prabhupada ends this purport. Krishna sarcastically addressed Arjuna as Mahabahu, mighty armed, because Arjuna at least did not accept the theory of the Vaibhashikas and does not leave aside the Vedic wisdom. In other words, it was understood between Krishna and Arjuna that Arjuna actually did not believe in this, but Krishna took it that far. You know, you could be speaking to somebody, so you can make an extreme case, hypothetical suggestion. Krishna said, well look, Arjuna, if you really want to go as far as being an atheist, well, which you're not, and so, but he made the point, even in that case, one should not give up his duty. As a Kshatriya, Arjuna belonged to the Vedic culture and it behooved him to continue to follow his principles. In other words, the student of the Gita is supposed to be like Arjuna. He's not expected to hold the view of these atheists. He's not expected. You should not have that. This problem should not be there. This view should not be there. Now, of course, at the end of the class, you can ask questions and we can discuss it. What if the view is there? Somebody's reading Bhagavad Gita, but I'll carry on for now. Text 27. So now, Krishna, first made the conclusion earlier that because the soul is indestructible, you should not lament. Then even if you believe that it dies and borns again and again, you should not lament. Now he makes a point which is common to both philosophies. Jatasya hi dhruvo mrityu, dhruvo janma mritasya cha, tasmat aparihariye arthe, na tam sochitam arhasi. There's one very nice word in this verse, this shloka. Aparihariye. It's, you know, there are two prefixes here, which, but the root of this word is hariye. Hariye means to stop, okay? Okay, so the word for word is aparihari, of that which is unavoidable. In other words, it's inevitable. In other words, it cannot be stopped. What cannot be stopped? This one who has taken his birth is sure to die, and after death one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, see, that's what's unavoidable. The discharge of the duty. You should not lament. In other words, you can't really avoid it. You can't get around it. Whether you have this philosophy or that philosophy, whether you accept the Vedic knowledge as revealed in the scriptures by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, or you don't. It cannot, you know, it's not optional. It's not optional, not without consequences. So, unavoidable discharge of your duty. You should not, so when it's a subject of doing one's duty, it's not really subject to the filter of our feelings. Lamentation is, you know, how do I feel about it? How do you feel? Duties are not sent to your desk for your evaluation. Do you feel today? You feel good? How do you feel? No, your feelings are not consulted. So, if you lament, really, what you're doing is you're just being foolish. Exactly what Krishna had said in the beginning of his instruction. Now, you see, of course he said it then, but now he's proven. Now he's proven why it's actually very foolish. Because he helped Arjuna to understand, look, all this is inevitable. How does, exactly what role does lamenting play in this? You see, let's say it's getting a little dusky and it'll become dark and it'll be night. And if I start lamenting, well, how does lamenting affect that becoming night? It'll still become night. Do you see how foolish? So, of course, that's a very mundane thing. But actually, that is the equivalent of what we do in when we start to make a fuss, make a drama. What is that phrase? Drama queen, right? Don't be a drama queen. Don't make a fuss. It's a duty. You can't get around it. It's not dependent on your approval. So Krishna actually has made a very cogent argument. Which, see, now interestingly, if you're a good student, you should be seeing the weaknesses, if you like. Because this is what Arjuna is going to do. He is following. He understands what Krishna is saying. So he's going to ask the right question. It's all leading up to that. So Prabhupada writes, one has to take birth according to one's activities of life. And after finishing one term of activities, one has to die to take birth for the next term of activities. By the way, I want you to know that in these two statements, Prabhupada is actually paraphrasing the verse again. Jatasya aparihariyarte. In other words, you have to take birth unavoidably. Aparihariye. It's not avoidable. Arte. Based on one's activities. Then mritasya aparihariyate. So your birth is inevitable, your mritasya is inevitable. In other words, your term of existence in one life is inevitable, your term of existence in the next body is inevitable. Okay. In other words, when you're born, you don't have the option of sitting still. There is some activity. And that's the word arte, by the way, is being played into it. That's the term of arte. In other words, there's an object to your birth and there's an object to your mritasya, means your next term of activities. There's an object, there's a purpose. And it is not just to sit still. Something will happen. Some activity will take place. And it's inevitable. Aparihariye. In this way, one is going through one cycle of birth and death after another without liberation. However, this cycle of birth and death does not support unnecessary murder, slaughter, and war. Now, if you remember in the previous class, we were mentioning that the fact that the soul never dies does not support unnecessary killing of anybody. And I'll ask you, what do you remember? The reason was because? Oh dear. Oh, this is testing now. No hands are coming up. Okay. Beg your pardon? But Mataji, you were not here in the previous class. So when we discussed, if you remember before, that because the soul is eternal and the body will die, it does not support killing, murder, and slaughter of other animals. It does not support. Why, I asked. The question was why. Because it was given a different reason. today, okay, since you're all a little hazy, we'll leave you, not punish. But you should go and find out. You should see what... Today, Prabhupada is giving another reason. That because there is a cycle of birth and death, does not support unnecessary murder, slaughter and war. You know, because somebody can say, well, hey, you know, that was his term of existence, and then, you know, I'm just helping him along. Just go to the next term. Right? It does not support that. So Prabhupada explains, but at the same time, violence and war are inevitable factors in human society for keeping law and order. In other words, this is Krishna's arrangement. Violence and war, in the sense of law and order, is part of Krishna's arrangement. It exists. But it does not support whimsical slaughter of other living beings. The battle of Kurukshetra, being the will of Krishna, was an inevitable event. And to fight for the right cause is the duty of a kshatriya. So here Prabhupada, what he's done, he's explaining this word aparihariye, inevitable. In other words, let's understand this for a second. Somebody may say, well, if Arjuna chose not to fight, it wasn't inevitable. No, but the war was. Krishna's will is inevitable. See, you see the point? The night coming is inevitable. Whatever I do, do you see? Whatever I do does not affect that daylight is going to give way to darkness of the night. That's the important. That's called aparihariya, inevitable. In other words, we're talking about Krishna's will, the arrangement. You may protest, you may say, I don't like it. Arjuna didn't like it, by the way. Did he like it? Did he like this arrangement? Did he say, oh joy, this is great. I was waiting all this time. When will I get a chance to kill my grandfather? No, he did not like it. But it was inevitable. Because Krishna, the supreme deity, by whose will everything conducts itself, wanted it. Whether Arjuna chose to participate or not, it was inevitable. You need to now get a little bit more, you know, involved. Okay. So now do you see, when something is inevitable, you cannot lament about it. This is a significant point. Very significant, actually. It's not subject for lamentation. We are spoiled, you see, we're like spoiled children. You know, the modern way of life is like bringing up children and spoiling them. What does spoiling mean? It means that they complain when really they have no... It does not matter if they complain or not, because things are going to happen that way. It's like a child complaining, oh, why is it going to be night? Which mother or father, however rich they may be, what can they possibly do about it? It will still become night, how rich or poor you may be. So people have lost this understanding of the duty that accrues from Krishna's arrangement is inevitable. It's not a choice. Now I'm going to say something here, just so you are tied together on what's to come. Your nature, your modes of nature, your chaturvarnya maya srishta is inevitable. You cannot escape it. You cannot circumvent it. You cannot get around it. You may have an operation as a transgender. Your duty will not change. Your modes of nature are there. They're inevitable. They're not optional. You cannot pick and choose. What would you like? From one term to the next, it is fixed. So Prabhupada, you must have heard some lectures, and I'll be very surprised if you have not heard a lecture where he says, what freedom? What is this freedom you keep on talking about? I'm free. How are you free? Never. No one is free. Aparihariye. You should understand the reality is you are caught. And you cannot even move by the fraction of a millimeter. This is called aparihariya. So where does lamenting help to make things good or bad? It doesn't do anything. It's a mistake. This verse, by the way, is quite significant. But we lose the significance because we lose the connection. We lose the connection. What role did it play? Because you see, we got brainwashed at some point for some unfortunate... I remember Prabhupada said this in class. He said, Yamaraj wants to punish you. So therefore you do not understand. Because if you understood, you'd advance. He wants to punish you. We lose the connection. What did this verse have to do with sarva dharma pratyaja? We've lost it. So we think this is all, okay, superfluous. Okay, and I'm in the 18th chapter. No, you missed. You missed all the connections. How is a cake made? Is it just the end part? All the ingredients, all that preparation was important in making the cake. You don't get a cake if you miss out the preparation. You cannot do sarva dharma pratyaja if you miss out. Chapter 2, text 27. Or chapter 2, text 1, 2, 3, 4. Chapter 1, 2. All of them. It's an important connection. This is very important. It stops us having foolish ideas in our head. Krishna has told Arjuna in no uncertain terms, my dear Arjuna, don't be spoiled child. This is not something you can opt out of. Your duty is not something you can opt out of. Even if you think you're not the soul, even if you think you're born and you die again and again and again, even if you're an atheist, it's very significant actually. So, just want to finish it and then we can take questions. We're at the end of it. The battle of Kurukshetra, being the will of the Supreme, was an inevitable event, and to fight for the right cause is the duty for a Kshatriya. And Prabhupada ends by elaborating on Natvam Sochitam Arhasi. You do not deserve to, you should not lament. Why then should Arjuna be aggrieved when he's discharging his inevitable duty? You see, why should you should see the sense now? You should see Prabhupada's question is very correct. It's a rhetorical question. It's a statement. In other words, Arjuna should not be aggrieved in the discharge of what is really inevitable. He did not deserve to break the law, thereby becoming subjected to the reaction of sinful acts of which he was so afraid. See, many times, sometimes people praise Arjuna's arguments, but actually they're mistaken. You have to understand this point. It's not that they had validity. They did not have validity. But what they did was, they expressed our thoughts. That's how we think. But it's erroneous understanding. It's based on an error. And the essence of the error is to think, I'm the architect of my life. You're not. What was the architect?
Oh. The expression goes, I'm the architect. You're the architect of your own fate.
Thank you. I'm not the architect of my fate in the sense, here and now, I can choose to do whatever I like. It's not true. This is a great error. And it's based on the idea that I am the body, that I have choices. Actually, we are coming into a situation which has the option of the space between my hands. Nothing. No option. You have to go on it. You can choose not to go on it, and then you can become subject to the sinful reaction. But actually, it's not avoidable. By avoiding the discharge of his proper duty, he would not be able to stop the death of his relatives, and he would be degraded due to the selection of the wrong path of action. So here's the thing, Arjuna was not subject to sinful reaction for killing his relatives, but for avoiding to do so. To sum it up, right? He was thinking, I will go to hell. And Krishna is telling you, you'll go to hell precisely because you don't kill them. You know, so that's the kind of education that's taking place here. Prabhupada wrote one time that Bhagavad Gita is a supreme instruction. I forget the rest of the phrase, but supreme instruction. In other words, actually it's not a song of God. It's the supreme instruction of God. He's teaching us. We should accept this as education. One of the obvious points to make from that deduction is that because Bhagavad Gita is not being taught as an education, people are suffering very much. I was thinking of our own gurukuls, by the way, not even secular education. Are there any questions? Comments, even? There's a mic just next to you or behind you. You may need to switch it on.
Thank you very much for the class. It's always good to hear someone who's diving deep into the philosophy, because we learn so much more. We can hear someone who's enthusiastic and able to present their ideas nicely. I have a little controversial question to ask, though.
You're welcome.
Because I also, like you and most of us, we give our classes usually to, it's like preaching to the choir, you know, and so everybody here is pretty, like you said, nice Vaishnavas, so no one's arguing. But when it comes to some term like anthropomorphism, someone who's not in our line, you know, understanding things coming from Bhaktisiddhanta, who clearly said that our bodies are theomorphic, that, you know, in other words, it's God has made us
in his image,
as the Bible says, or as Plato says, you know, that there is a perfect form. Many modern people will say, and quite rightly, that anthropomorphism happens all the time. We talk about the man in the moon. We talk about, you know, ships get names, they're she's. All the time in entertainment, There's talking dogs and talking elephants and animals that have been given human form. I mean, we just see it in our natural everyday parlance. I mean, in the 1960s, there was a very popular program in the United States about a talking horse, and the horse was very smart, smarter than his owner. So the point being is that since we see anthropomorphizing everywhere done as a matter of course, our life, sometimes we give human qualities to an animal. They don't have a human quality, they're an animal. Why isn't it a reasonable thing to believe that a human being would project their own image into the divine, not knowing anything better than that? I mean, and so here you have a person asking a very reasonable question like that, and we can't just tell them, well, because it says so.
No.
I would
agree with him. Because even Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, if I'm not mistaken, said that it is idolatry when a person, conceives of the supreme deity in that way, and he will do that without higher, knowledge, access to Vedic knowledge. In other words, anthropomorphism is almost inevitable without Vedic knowledge. In other words, you can't escape it because of that conditioning, which we're doing already. So if that pattern is brought into religion, then the result will be anthropomorphic religion.
If I might say, like in the Sistine Chapel, the picture of God touching
Adam. Where he's reaching.
Yeah, reaching out. God's very old.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Thank you. That's a good example. Prabhupada uses that people think that because God is the oldest of all, so then he must be really very, very old, Perhaps still muscular, just like the Sistine Chapel, exactly. That's what Michelangelo's portrayal was, that this is what God must be. But so that's idolatry even, not even just, in other words, it's a figment of your imagination, you see. And that can also be labeled pantheism like that because you're, it's all to do with your sights and sounds of your experience that you... But Vedic knowledge is not like that. I was going to... You gave a number of examples. One of them was she attributing it to a river and other things. And I happen to be a student of history too, back from England. And it's interesting. It's not all anthropomorphism, actually. Actually, the West... Excuse me. A burp there. The West is a combination of two things. One is, what they used to do was destroy the previous ideas, ancient ideas. They thought were... but you see, what they were actually Vedic in origin, even throughout the world. They were Vedic in origin. And there was an effort to discredit them by, in essence, Prabhupada used this phrase, by giving the dog a bad name and hanging it. You give a dog a bad name, hang it or kick it. There are two versions of this statement. But in other words, they vilified all those things, even when they had merit. Even those things had merit, they would just, give a bad name. And then it got subsumed into the idea that all these things were actually anthropomorphic. No, so it's a mixture. Some of it is Vedic knowledge coming down, which was vilified. So the West is not completely anthropomorphic. It's a mixture. And India today is becoming like that too. It's a repeat of what has happened a few hundred years ago in the West. It's happening today in India, where things that are part of Vedic knowledge are being conveniently labeled together with superstition. And together, love is useless. You see, in face of modern knowledge, scientific, you know, iPads and, you know, computers and things, technology, engineering. So all of it looks backward and primitive. But if you can isolate the actual Vedic component of all understanding, it's actually beyond the reach of our senses, and it's there. The highest minds in the West have yet not been able to grapple with the most basic revelations of Vedic knowledge, such as the complete and perfect understanding of the mind, the intelligence, the ego, and consciousness. They look foolish. Their ideas look foolish compared to what is revealed in just the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's very profound. You know, that was part of my material background, so I have some knowledge of this. And it's, you know, you try to find holes in it. See, because here you've got Vedic knowledge unencumbered with other foolish notions, you see. It's pristine. It's protected in evam parampara praptam. The shlokas are there. You know. Dehina asmin yata dehe ko. Very perfect. It's not just song. It's not. You should find fault. There's no hole in it. It's actually, the astounding thing about perfect knowledge is there's something called axiomatic truth, even understood in the West. Axiomatic. It's not truth you can directly test, but whatever its derivations, whatever it predicts, you can test. So whilst you cannot test the soul as described in the second chapter, but all that it derives from it is perfect. The identity of the person maintains even though the body is physically different from one stage of his life to the next, to the next, to the next. That's a fact. He doesn't go through any such change. There's no component in the body that survives all those changes, only the soul. Now, Krishna doesn't say from the point of view of, well, this scientist did an experiment based on this, and this is revealed knowledge. This is perfect. This is how it is. This is what the soul is. This is what the body is. This is what the mind is. But what we've learned today was that, aside from the soul being eternal, is that one's duty is unavoidable. See, so far, everyone thinks the second chapter is all just about the soul. Actually, it is Bhagavad Gita, contents of the Bhagavad Gita summarized. There are many, many factors that are being thrown in here, which are the subject of careful consideration. We will benefit tremendously if we can pay attention to some of these details. But just to finish off, it can't be helped with these people, really. I mean, even their subjects, if you go with the attitude to them and say, well, prove me everything you say in the physics lecture, you know, I want to see it, I won't believe it unless you show. It's not possible. It's never done. You have to believe this, the professor, the teacher. So Vedic knowledge by definition demands that you do not challenge the teacher. You have to be submissive. You have to have full faith. You have to serve menially, happily. So the requirement is there, and there are people with enough pious credits to be able to do that even today, who can take advantage. Sorry, I don't know if I fully answered you. But any
I think this is kind of thing going on.
Yeah, I know, so I didn't want to keep.
Yeah.
Yes, but can you pass the mic, please? Would you get the mic? I guess all of you noticed we begin 5:30 now, right? The time has changed. Some of you might have come earlier, which made a change. You know that. Normally I'm here before everybody. Today, for the first time, I saw everybody here before me. I thought, wow, this is good. We announced 5 o'clock, I turned up at 5:30.
That's
good.
Yeah.
I have a question. If a person is attempting to convey this message, to share this information, this knowledge, how can it be conveyed? Regardless of whether the other person who is the listener has the merits, security, etc. If the person who is the listener has a complete different world view, right? A complete map. That's completely different. How is this message going to be conveyed?
Yeah. So I was hoping that example I mentioned during the class, that, night is inevitable at this time. You know. There are things people can relate to. So then you say, well, what's Krishna saying? So you have to say what Krishna says, and then you have to have the ability to connected to his world, to what he can relate to, what he can understand. Krishna, of course, is not saying, oh, by the way, the night is inevitable. But he's speaking that, why lament over something that is inevitable? Now here, the question comes up, well, I don't know if I have to fight is inevitable. But what Krishna is saying is, even if you agree not to do it, the fight will happen. Just like night is going to take place. Why is that? Because we're talking about Krishna here. So of course, you see, we live in a world where we think everything is avoidable, wars are avoidable. Poverty doesn't have to happen. Disease can be eradicated. We think this, is it not? We think all of this is possible. Only some man is purposely doing it. We lose this idea that actually man is nothing. We have to allow a person to get over this infatuation, this thing he has in his head that man is in control. So just, I don't know if you can say everything, but at least we have to. One time one preacher said, he said, even if you don't convince them, at least make sure they don't sleep tonight. They have a doubt.
So it sounds like you're appealing to the intellect, right, by relating the information in terms that they can understand.
Well, at least this is what Krishna is doing to Arjuna at this stage.
Okay, through their own personal experience.
Right.
Is there another way?
You probably have something in mind?
I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, the other way is just to give him prasad and say, let the Lord work his magic, you know.
Not everybody responds to the intellect.
No, so therefore we have weapons and we have secret weapons. And then Prabhupada said, even our matajis are our weapons, you know. Matajis, yeah. So, you know, we've got weapons. I'm sorry?
They mean it's like kirtan.
Yeah.
They hear the kirtan, like, oh, that's a nice melody.
Yeah, something.
Yeah.
We've got a whole range of brahmastras, you know?
So it's more like actually enabling the person to have an experience. Because the intellect can go this way, it can actually reject. Because that person is not prepared to accept this philosophical truth.
Perhaps the answer, I should put it like this, is that if you think he's capable of intellect, give it to him. If he's not, then don't. If you evaluate, if you think he has the capacity, do. And surprisingly, some people do relate to it, by the way. Not everyone is, you know, incapacitated or God has given people abilities. And sometimes they say, oh, you said something profound there. Now, mostly people are not used to profound conversation. But Bhagavad Gita is profound.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other? Oh, yeah.
Hare Krishna.
So there are two swakarmas, like one pertaining to the body and another to the soul. So if I give one example, like if one is a person is doing some activity like his householder or brahmachari or something, not in his corner but outside, and he said that, oh, I'm now bored with this my material occupation, and now I will leave my occupation and join his corner brahmachari or something. So is that means avoiding the duty?
Yes, it can be, by the way. It can be.
So is it right or what is wrong?
Well, it has to be. The can be means I need more information. But I was just going to give you a general indicator. Prabhupada, surprisingly, he, in many lectures, especially in Vrindavan, right there, he would speak of that Krishna consciousness is not to go into secluded place and chant Hare Krishna. I think most of you must be familiar with this theme of Prabhupada's. But surprisingly, what he said it was to be active. And then, of course, somebody may think, well, you know, I'm active, I'm kirtan or whatever. He said, to active means to be engaged in your occupational duty. You know, it just got more and more precise. Because sometimes if you stop the tape and you can make up your own idea what is active until you hear his specific, and he was very specific. So if a person joins ISKCON and gives up his occupational duty, there is some danger that he may be trying to become secluded, actually. Which Prabhupada said is impossible. And on the other hand, if he joins ISKCON in the right way, in the right spirit, and became active in his occupational duty, in the service of the Lord, that's wonderful. So it depends. It could be good, it could be bad.
So it means that he has to use his previous tendency in Krishna service.
He has to act under the guidance of an expert, experienced spiritual master. He should not be doing anything whimsical. What is that? Yashastra vidhim utsrijya vartate kama karata nasa siddhim avapnoti. Na sukham, na parangati. So, kama karata should not be whimsical. He should be guru karata, whatever the spiritual master says, who takes responsibility for him. So that's it's very different than just our concocted ideas, you know, that suit our convenience. I'm fed up. I didn't like my wife. So I'll join. I'm surrendered. Something, I don't know. Maybe a mistake. Is that okay? Any other questions or comments? Yes, Mataji.
You were talking about how we can't change our nature, and you gave the example of a transgender person.
Yeah.
But it seems that's precisely why they became a transgender, because they felt their nature is so strongly the opposite sex. So they changed because they couldn't relate.
I tried to plant words, which I hope provoke a question. I finally got one. Yeah. Here's the thing. Whilst a person... See... Sometimes what happens is a devotee, a scientist of Bhagavad Gita, who is trying to understand it and evaluate everything in the world through the eyes of the Bhagavad Gita. One of the mistakes is that we think people's choice to do sinful activity, some or other, is avoiding their nature. Avoiding, the not a, voiding, nullifying. So, think of this carefully. There are a number of things taking place when you see a picture. There's the layer of his choice of agreeing to abide by his prescribed nature, by his prescribed occupational duty. And there's the layer of his sinful actions. So the part which is prescribed is not ever changed by whatever you do. So much so, your change of body, he at least gets an operation done. Everybody gets operated after every 7 years, according to medical science. You've just been given a new plastic surgery, you know, from head to toe. Everybody. What that does not change is your occupational duty, your nature. But what you can do on top of that, because you are a human body, unlike the animal body, is you can do sinful things. So when a person sees the picture, he's seeing two layers. He's not seeing the one only. And he thinks because he did sinful activity, oh, he just voided his nature. He just changed it. He was a man, now he's a woman. Nothing has changed. All he did was Ado Gachanti Tamasa. Went into the darkest regions of hell.
So you're saying it's sinful. I actually know someone, a devotee, who was a man, Indian, and he became a woman. And at least in India, she became teaching women, beauty and etiquette and poise and, you know, how to dress. And so certainly changing his nature and changing his occupation and everything, having surgery and the voice and, you know, and everything. You wouldn't know unless you knew that it used to be a man.
I'm not disputing that, Mataji. I purposely chose the word in my class, knowing what the word means. Meaning, a person changes his sex completely. I'm aware of that. And I'm still trying to point out that no matter what changes you can bring about, no matter what, and the extremest one I could think of in my mind was transgender. That's why I chose it. It will not change the inevitable. Now, on top of the inevitable, you can do misbehavior. Now the component of the inevitable, that's why I said you need sober reflection. I'm not going to do it in the case of a person I don't know. Yeah. I leave it to you. The tools are there. Arjuna, I'm just going to give the example that's in front of us. Arjuna could have chosen not to fight, but he would not have avoided the war. Why? God. You see, look at what's inevitable. Whatever God's will is, that's inevitable. This is the point. Is a person able to nullify janma, mritu, jara, vyadi? For example, just to pick on the pedantic most obvious thing. But like this, there are many, many subtle things which we also cannot avoid at all as well. Not just birth, death, old age, and disease. So many things. In other words, the attempt to do this is mistaken itself. Just that. It's not what change he made, whether he was successful or not. Arjuna, for example, could have been a very successful beggar. That's who knows, I don't know. He could have been the best. Sannyasi, I don't. But that's not the point. It's not based on your success after your change. It's seeing, in other words, what is it? For example, the West is considered successful. Big skyscrapers, big automobiles, big everything. But did Prabhupada say this was success? You know what he said to Tribhuvanas one time? He said, all drops of water in a mirage. And I was like, stunned. You know when you're standing in New York looking at Manhattan, and he's seeing it all as drops of water in a mirage. We're very impressed. Prabhupada's sense of being impressed was one big mirage. But of course Prabhupada would pronounce it as mirage, which is very appealing. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki Srila Prabhupada.